From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Washington Mutual experienced the biggest bank failure in the nation's history. How did it happen? Why was the Seattle-based bank allowed to go down where others were propped up? Kirsten Grein answers those questions in her new book called The Lost Bank. Kirsten Grein is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She researched 10,000 documents and interviewed more than 200 people to tell the story of the bank that used to brand itself as Friend of the Family. She was covering WaMu when she was reporting for the Puget Sound Business Journal, and that's where this book had its genesis. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So it's really a story of two crises, one of which WaMu survived and the other which it didn't. I mean, it was one of those small banks that America had for years and years. They had the saying they'd pay 3% interest and then the bankers would be out the door by 3 p.m. to go golfing, kind of low key. But the whole banking industry really kind of changed in the 1980s, and they were in a bit of trouble. They were kind of falling behind. So they brought in an attorney, this guy who'd never run a bank before, although he was familiar with the banking industry, this guy Lou Pepper. He took it over, and he saved WaMu. How did he bring it out of that first crisis it had back then?
Absolutely. So Lou took over this very small bank that was known around here as the Friend of the Family. That was really what they were known as. And he grew it into this very stable regional bank and then turned over the reins to CEO Kerry Killinger. And then you just saw this bank take off. Through the 90s, it grew astronomically across the country, became the country's largest savings and loan bank. And then it unfortunately took a turn for the worse. It began growing its mortgage operation hugely and expanded into risky mortgage loans. Its slogan became the power of yes. We will make your home loan at any price. And then, of course, we all know what happens to WaMu. They failed in September 2008.
And WaMu got huge through mergers and through mortgages. How did those mergers get jump-started?
Well, the mergers actually weren't the problem initially, because through the 90s, for about a decade, WaMu was buying a lot of other savings and loan banks. So those were very stable institutions. They're the kind of banks that we historically think of. What started changing was in about 2001, when the bank began buying other mortgage operations, and it bought a small subprime lending operation known as Long Beach Mortgage. And so that's when things really started to change.
The corporate culture seems as though it changed a lot, too. It was kind of iconoclastic back in the earlier days, wasn't
it? Absolutely. This is one of the tragedies of the story. So WaMu had this amazing corporate culture that really started with its old CEO, Lou Pepper. People just loved to work there. They would, you know, do things like dress up for Halloween and go to the branches and bring candy and things like this. And as they grew so much bigger, you saw this corporate culture really start to erode. And then as the mortgage operation grew bigger and they brought in all these East Coast executives, you know, no one sort of cared about that thing anymore. And they were just very much hard driving at that point.
And Lou Pepper, he was kind of a pistol, wasn't he?
He was. And bless his heart, I mean, he tried his best from a distance to really intervene when things were getting very bad. But you can imagine how that is to see sort of this older CEO come in and try to change things at the bank. So he was very much ignored.
Well, he brought in the man who helped build and eventually brought down Washington Mutual, Kerry Killinger. Tell us a little bit about him. Where did he come from? What kind of a person was he?
So Kerry was this a very, very smart guy. He's from Iowa. He took over the bank. He was quite young in 1990, and he grew it into this giant bank. And he was so well respected across the country. I mean, he was America's favorite banker at one point. And then what happened, unfortunately, is that he really started believing his own press. He divorced his longtime wife of 30 years, who had really kept him grounded. He married a new wife and really began sort of believing in the trappings of a CEO. He was flying around the country on a corporate jet, all the while the bank was growing its mortgage division.
You relate in the earlier days, he had the He was called the Energizer Banker.
Yes.
And he was fond of Beavis and Butthead, which you don't associate with heads of banks.
I'm so glad you noticed that detail. Yeah, he was someone that was not what you would necessarily call a social butterfly. You know, a lot of employees had these stories about in the early days having to ride up in elevators with him, and it was very awkward making conversation, and he was very hard to sort of get to know. But then you really saw that change as the bank grew much bigger and he became comfortable with his sort of role as CEO. He started flying around the country holding all these brand rallies for employees, and he became almost like a rock star and became very comfortable speaking in public and very charismatic.
Well, the big problem that banks got into in this era was that they were kind of aggressively pushing mortgages on people who had no hope of paying them back. And is that what was going on with Washington Mutual?
Oh, absolutely. I spent a lot of time actually out in California, which was the heart of these risky mortgage lending operations at almost all banks, not just WaMu. And you know what was just so interesting is these people, they had a sense that what they were doing was just completely ridiculous and wrong. But it was almost like Stockholm Syndrome, that syndrome where you're kidnapped and you start to sympathize with your captor. They just really couldn't see it for what it was until after the fact. And so they just kept making these mortgages thinking, well, we're hearing someone on Wall Street way back east is just going to take care of this for us. And by the way, they were making a ton of money.
Yeah. Are there any heroes here who were inside Washington Mutual who were seeing this going on and kind of trying to put the brakes on it?
There were definitely people like that there. There were several executives, including their former chief legal officer and one of their chief risk officers, who were constantly trying to sound alarms. But imagine this place where even at the highest levels of the federal government, they were sort of condoning short-term lending. They were saying that there wasn't going to be a housing crisis. It was sort of this pervasive thinking throughout our entire system. So it was very, very hard to convince anyone to listen to them.
Well, it began to slow down for Washington Mutual. They kind of had a run on the bank, but your book actually begins at the end. And they thought they might be out of the woods, and then this phone call comes.
Yes, it's terrible. I mean, so WaMu has a very controversial ending. Right at the end, Kerry Killinger was ousted as its CEO, and they brought in a new guy, Alan Fishman, who really thought he could save this bank. But then they started suffering after Lehman Brothers collapsed, this gigantic deposit outflow that no one even heard about. It was just like the 1930s, people pulling their money out. And he was trying desperately to save it. He had come up with a rescue plan. But to be honest, WaMu just didn't have any friends in Washington at that point. And so the bank failed.
And when the federal government shut down WaMu, as I recall, some of the executives were saying, we could have held on. They shut us down too soon. What was your evaluation of that claim?
I believe that they're correct. I spent a lot of time looking at the numbers, so their liquidity figures and their financial health on the day of their collapse. Now, there is absolutely no question that this was a bank in completely dire straits. It either needed to be sold on the open market or it needed some kind of government assistance down the road. But it wasn't running out of money that day, as they would have liked to paint that picture. And the executives at the time had actually put together a rescue plan that could have moved the bank forward, but they just couldn't get any attention from federal regulators.
Why not? Why do you suppose that is? Is it because it was just up here in the upper left-hand corner?
Well, that's one of the reasons. This is a very good lesson in how important it is these days for big companies and especially big banks to have friends in Washington. So Kerry Killinger never made a huge effort to make those connections. We're very far out here in Seattle. He was there not very often. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan Chase, the eventual purchaser of WaMu, who had long wanted the bank, you know, politics
they got a
are their
fire
seventh
sale on
line
it.
Of yeah.
yeah,
and politics are their seventh line of business. So they're sort of behind the scenes making all these connections. They're in Washington talking badly about WaMu's financial condition, basically, and you can see how that turned out.
Well, many of us know people who worked for WaMu. A lot of people lost their jobs. A lot of people sort of believing this hometown image and invested money in WaMu. And investors completely were cleaned out.
They were completely wiped out. And the bankruptcy of WaMu after it was seized and sold actually wiped out bondholders as well, which is very rare. So that means the group that had invested $7 billion just a few months earlier also was wiped out. It was a huge shock to the system.
There was a criminal investigation into WaMu executives. What was the outcome of that?
So the outcome of that was essentially that nothing was found.
Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the end of it. There was also the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, sued those WaMu executives for negligence. And there was a settlement in that, right?
Exactly. There was. So this was a very very unusual move. The FDIC was the government agency that seized the bank, and seizing WaMu, it didn't cost the deposit insurance fund any money. So the FDIC didn't actually lose any money, but it still decided to sue the top three executives for about $1 billion, claiming negligence. And they negotiated on this for several months and then eventually came to a settlement. And so that lawsuit also didn't move forward.
Went from $1 billion to $64 million. That's quite a haircut on the initial.
And much of that, I'll just point out, was actually paid by insurance policies. So the executives didn't really pay much of that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the fascinating story of Washington Mutual. It's called Lost Bank by Kirsten Grind. You might remember her work with the Puget Sound Business Journal, where she was covering a lot of this stuff initially. Well, she went back, got a lot more documents, talked to hundreds of people who were involved in it to write this book, which is just a really compelling story, kind of another take on what went on in the economic collapse around our own hometown bank here. Do you think that where are these executives now? Have they ended up wealthily retired somewhere?
Well,
they're not in jail.
They're not in jail, and they're not on the street asking for money. They haven't emerged in the financial sector at all. They're mostly retired. There's a couple that are still in banking positions, but not Kerry Killinger, for example, has not emerged in any banking positions. He's still here in Seattle and also in Palm Desert.
There's been a lot of speculation about if the government, federal government, had stricter regulations, this wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. You've had a chance to really look closely at the WaMu situation. Do you think that's true? Is it partly a failure of government regulation?
I absolutely believe that's true. I mean, the federal regulators, it's astounding what they missed along the way. And part of the problem, which we don't talk about very much, is that there were huge turf battles among the regulators in Washington. So often, and I piece this together in WaMu's story, but I'm confident it's happened at other banks, is that they were arguing over whose job it was to regulate rather than actually regulating. And so for that reason, I'm a bit discouraged by some of the Dodd-Frank financial regulation we're talking about, because they're actually adding regulatory bodies, which on the one hand is great. But on the other hand, I just wonder, is that going to even make the problem worse?
How about just the fiduciary responsibilities of the board of directors of a publicly run company like WaMu? Shouldn't they have been looking out for the shareholders' interests?
Absolutely. This was a board that was used to a CEO and an executive team that had outperformed in every way for about 15 years. And they were lulled by that. They were, I mean, I will go so far as to say that they really dropped the ball. I mean, they were sort of sitting there. They saw the crisis. They were seeing reports about the housing crisis. They were seeing other problems across the country, and they really took no direct action to stop it until it was too late.
Is the WaMu story over? Are there more shoes to drop?
I mean, there's not any huge shoes to drop in this story, but the effects of WaMu are just still everywhere across the country. I mean, you see it in the foreclosure rates that are still driving down appraisals and home prices everywhere across the country. Investors are still being damaged by the mortgage-backed securities that they hold from WaMu. So it just continues on.
This is a huge amount of research on this book. Are there still things about the story that you don't know?
You know, one of the questions that I could never, ever get answered, and I perhaps will never have a great question to this or a great answer to this, is that, you know, I just, the executives at the bank, they actually saw the housing crisis coming. They sent emails to each other saying housing prices can't sustain at this level. They were emailing back and forth, and yet they still pursued this risky mortgage strategy. And I must have asked everyone this question 8 different ways. Even a congressional committee asked the executives this question, and there was no good answer as to why they continued to push forward, except that they were so focused on market share.
Wow.
I will never understand that logic.
Maybe some psychological factor having to do with it's going really great. They just maybe couldn't believe where
it was
heading off that cliff.
Yes.
Now, I understand that part of the reason that you got an agent interested in this book was a previous interview on KUOW. Is that right?
Yes. So actually, I probably should be giving you guys a chunk of the sales for hooking me up with that agent. Absolutely. Yes. I think she had just heard me speaking about the articles.
And now it is the book, The Lost Bank, The Story of Washington Mutual, The Biggest Bank Failure in American History, a really detailed look at the people and the story behind what went on, which had such a grave effect on us. The author is Kirsten Krein. Thank you very much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Allie Ferguson. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is KQOW 94.9 Seattle.